Support for this episode of Judaism Unbound comes from the Ashman Family JCC in Palo Alto, California, whose vision is to be the architects of the Jewish future. The Ashman Family JCC is an incubator for new expressions of Jewish identity. It creates innovative Jewish learning, celebrations, and arts programs that inspire personal connections to people and ideas from across the Jewish world. Learn more at www.paloaltojcc.org. This is Judaism Unbound, episode 133. God is One. Welcome back, everyone. I'm Dan Liebenson.
And I'm Lex Rofberg.
And today we're taking our exploration of the relationship of American Jews and God into a more mystical direction. Our guest today is Arthur Green, also known as Art Green. Rabbi Art Green is one of the leading American Jewish theologians, the leading practitioner and proponent of what he calls Neo-Hasidism, which, as he explains it, involves loving and learning from the great spiritual revival of Judaism that took place in Eastern Europe 200 years ago, while choosing to live outside the strictly regulated world of the contemporary Hasidic community. Art Green may be the only person who has led two different rabbinical schools. He is currently the rector of the rabbinical school at Hebrew College in Boston, where he also serves as the Irving Brudnick Professor of Jewish Philosophy and Religion. He was the founding dean of Hebrew College Rabbinical School and also served as dean and president of the Reconstructionist Rabbinical College. Rabbi Art Green has also been Professor Art Green in the world of American academia. He was a professor of Jewish mysticism, Hasidism, and theology at the University of Pennsylvania, and he was also the Philip W. Lowne Professor of Jewish Thought at Brandeis University, where he is now Professor Emeritus. Art Green is the author of many important books, including Seek My Face, A Jewish Mystical Theology, Eheyeh, A Kabbalah for Tomorrow, Radical Judaism, Rethinking God and Tradition, and Judaism's 10 Best Ideas, A Brief Guide for Seekers. He is at work on a number of new projects, including a two-volume exploration of Neo-Hasidism, a commentary on the prayer book, and other projects. It's a great honor to have him today with us on Judaism Unbound. Rabbi Art Green, welcome to Judaism Unbound. It's such a thrill to have you on.
Thank you. Nice to be here with you.
Well, we're in the midst of this series exploring the question of how God will relate to the present and future of Judaism. And we thought it was really interesting to talk to you, who co-founded a rabbinical school and has an important role there. And on the other hand, you know, that you describe yourself in ways such as not quite a theist, mystical panentheist, monism, I think is a term that you use. You talk a lot about the One. And I was wondering if you could sort of put all those pieces together and help us understand who God is that you are involved with.
Well, you jump right in, don't you? I have been a Jewish seeker and a struggler around the questions of faith for a very long time. I think I will begin with my grandmother. My father's mother, who was an atheist still in the, already in the old country before she came to America, wrote me a letter when I decided to go to rabbinical school. It was written in what we call night school English, all one sentence. I still have it. It reads like this. Dear Arthur, I hear you still want to be a rabbi. I would be prouder of you if you would be a teacher and teach people things that are true, because if there was a God in the sky, he would be shut down by Sputnik already, period. I have tried very hard to do my grandmother's bidding and not to believe in the kind of God who could be shut down by Sputnik already, which is to say the fellow in the sky is somebody who essentially disappeared for me a long time ago. I decided I was not a believer in a God who is a conscious being in the way that we humans understand consciousness, who lives beyond the universe, and who controls the fate of creatures in this universe in a willful way. That's what I would call classic Western theism. When I lost that faith, I tried on secularism for a while, tried to be, oh, I'm a secular Jew, it's all about culture, it's all about literature. I tried on both Yiddishist and Zionist versions of Jewish secularism, and then discovered I was still a religious seeker, which is to say, I was still looking for a Judaism that talked about why we live and why we die, and what we're doing here in this brief instant that we flicker across the screen of evolutionary history. And so I found myself turning back to religious language. I was at that point in life, you can say coincidentally or providentially, introduced to the language of Kabbalah and Hasidism, where God is much more a matter of being and nothingness, than a personal fellow in the sky. And I realized that was a religious language I could speak and a religious language that spoke to my soul. There is only one. That is to say, all beings are united within the single phenomenon of being. That which is indicated by the Hebrew word Yud-Heh-Vav-Heh, which is the word I prefer to use for God. Yud-Heh-Vav-Heh, we're not allowed to pronounce it, but it is, in fact, an impossible conflation of the verb to be. It is best translated was as will be, with hyphens in between, was as will be, because it's past, present, and future at once. It's not G-O-D. G-O-D, a word that comes, after all, from the Norse and Germanic tradition. Yes, it originally designated the gods of Europe, and then was used when the Bible was translated into English, and German and English, it became God. So I feel no obligation to that word G-O-D and the implications it has. I do feel lots of implication to Yud-Heh-Vav-Heh, which to me is the oneness of being and the fact that all beings are part of a single being and that it is manifest and present in each of them and lies behind them and within them and unites them. That's what I mean by God. So my religion is a devotion to awareness of that one and the use of Judaism as a symbolic language to cultivate and demonstrate that awareness.
And when you think about that, or I guess I'm asking both when the Kabbalists, when the original Jewish mystics, let's say, in the Middle Ages thought about that, or the early Hasidic rabbis thought about that, did they understand themselves somehow, did they somehow understand the earlier language of Judaism that talked about God in a much more personal way, in a way of an entity that had a body that could be talked to, that had desires, that had commands? You know, did they sort of understand that their ideas were projected backwards and that somehow that earlier language was being used because people could only understand a more personal kind of God? Or did they sort of understand themselves to be discovering something new and creating sort of a new perspective? And then I guess I'm asking, how do you think about that for you?
Judaism is layered. It's such an ancient tradition that you have layer upon layer. And the rules of the game were, you never deny the truth of the prior layers, you just reinterpret them. So rabbinic religion comes along and doesn't really believe in the fierce tribal God that you meet in the back pages of the Book of Numbers, the Book of Deuteronomy. But it never said, oh, those Torah passages are untrue, we have to extirpate them. It just kept them and put another layer on top of them. Jewish philosophy did the same thing. Maimonides certainly believed, understood. Maimonides, a great Jewish philosopher in 12th century Egypt, certainly understood that his beliefs were very different than the beliefs of early biblical and rabbinic authors. No question he understood that, but he also wanted to keep the tradition going. He is the great rabbi as well as the great philosopher, and therefore he gives you an Aristotelian notion of God, that God is the cause of all causes, the ultimate unknowable one, completely denies anthropomorphism. Well, he looks back at the biblical text. Is he saying then that the biblical text is idolatrous? Oh, he wouldn't say that. But yes, he understood that's another layer. The Kabbalists did the same thing. For example, they say the Zohar, the great work of medieval Jewish mysticism, says the personal God, the God who is king and sits on the throne and rules the world, is born out of the womb of Bina, of the cosmic mother, which is beyond God. Now that's absolutely pagan. So in other words, the personal God is born out of the great mystery, which is beyond it. I would say, my change to that, the Kabbalists would say the personal God is born out of the great mystery beyond it. I would say the personal God is born out of our need to reach toward the great mystery beyond it. In other words, I think we have an active role in the birthing of that personal God. All of our understandings of God, all of our pictures of God are human projections. We have no pictures in our skulls that aren't projections somehow. So therefore, all of our imaginings of God are fantasy. Fantasy to me is not a dirty word. Doesn't mean it's a lie. Doesn't mean it's untrue. Fantasy is good. You remember maybe Franz Kafka has a wonderful parable called The Great Emperor, where the emperor on his deathbed, it's like it's a picture sort of Imperial China without us ever saying so. The emperor on his deathbed has sent a message for you, and it's meant for you alone. But the throng around the emperor's bed is so tremendous that one could never, the messenger will never be able to get through that throng. And if you ever got through that throng, then he'd be in the inner courtyard. The inner courtyard is packed with people. You couldn't possibly imagine just getting through that. And then there's the outer courtyard, and then there's the hall, and you sit far away at the end of the world. That message will never reach you. And then he says, but you sit by the window as evening falls and dream it to yourself. That doesn't mean there's no message, but we have to help create it. Sometimes I like to play with God creates us in the divine image, and we are obliged to return the favor. Sometimes I like to say, all religion is projection, but the mystics understand that there's a great hall of mirrors, and that hall of mirrors can be opened from either end. You can peek in from our end and say, oh, the image at the other end is a projection of us, but you could also imagine peeking in from the upper end, saying, oh, that image down there is a projection of what's above.
I'm soaking all this in, and I'm also realizing that for many of our listeners, probably, I'm not talking to them right now, but I'm guessing that for many of them, the kind of conceptions of God that you are naming as your own and as those of many Jewish mystics, they're probably very new in their minds. And what I really appreciated, they're not new, like they're new to those
lists. I understand they're new to them because the Judaism they got was censored.
Right, and that's exactly what I want to ask a little bit about, because you talk about this beautifully. You mentioned that as much as there were these major big battles sort of ideologically between reformers and Orthodox folks in the 1800s, 1900s. I mean, what they sort of united around was a shared disdain for mysticism. And they sort of each painted this picture that that is somehow un-Jewish and not something that is part of the tradition. And they kind of succeeded in painting that picture such that many of us never heard of these ideas. So I'd love to hear sort of what happened there and the broader story behind why we don't think of mystic conceptions of God as another Jewish possibility.
Good for you. Well, that will take us a little while, but that's all right. That's why we're here. From the 16th to the 18th centuries, I would say, Kabbalah was the ideology most Jews believed in. I'm not saying they were all Kabbalists. They didn't understand it. But if you ask them what the truth was, they would say, oh, the Kabbalists are people who know. The Zohar is the great book of wisdom. The Zohar was venerated like the Bible and the Talmud. It was the third great book of Judaism. In the late 18th century, first in Germany, Jews begin to westernize. At the turn of the 19th century, I can actually trace it to the second decade of the 19th century, a new concept was created that had never existed before. And that was something called mainstream Judaism. Das Judentum in ihrer Hauptströmung, somebody said in German, Judaism in its mainstreams. There is no way to say that in Hebrew, mainstream Judaism. In Israel, they say Yadut mainstream, because there's no proper Hebrew term for it. It was a new idea. Mainstream Judaism meant anything that will be acceptable to modern westernizing Jews. Anything that will look good to the liberal Protestants and deists who have first admitted us into polite company outside the ghetto walls is mainstream Judaism. Anything that will be embarrassing to us, that makes us look primitive, will be swept under the rug. We don't have to teach it. We don't have to pass it on. It's not really part of mainstream Judaism. We probably got it from somebody else. It's probably not real Judaism. So the mystical tradition for westernizing Jews from the turn of the 19th century was intentionally swept under the rug. You read the great mid-19th century Jewish historian Heinrich Goetz, who wrote the history of the Jews that everybody emulated. And the Kabbalists were charlatans. They were charlatans. They were ripping people off. The Hasidic rebbes were stealing money of poor people. And this was all fakery. And that was the main view of the mystical tradition that came into the West. That lasted a long time. When my revered teacher, Abraham Joshua Heschel, I was a student at JTS, wanted to teach a course in Hasidism in the early 1960s, late 1950s, early 1960s, he was told, you can't teach Hasidism as one of your regular courses because Hasidism is not mainstream Judaism. You may teach Maimonides, you may teach Yehuda Halevi, another great philosopher, but Hasidism is not the mainstream. Heschel taught us a little seminar on Hasidism on his own time because that was not an acceptable part of Judaism. I'm not saying just conservative seminary. All of the Western institutions did not teach it. Gershom Scholem, the great critical historian of Kabbalah, rediscovered Kabbalah in some ways in the second quarter of the 20th century and began writing and publishing about it. He had a number of disciples and a number of people around the world who read him. I was fortunate enough to be a student, an undergraduate at Brandeis in 1960, when Alexander Altman, who had read Scholem, came to the United States from England and taught the first course on Kabbalah ever taught in an American university. And I was an undergraduate in that class. So Kabbalah just entered even academic respectability after the 1960s. Now that's changed dramatically in the last, let's say, 30 years. One of the most important transformations of Judaism, I would say from 1990 on to our day, is the search to re-embrace the mystical tradition. 200 years after it was swept under the rug, we find large numbers of Jews wanting to reclaim it. The question is how to do it properly. What's worthwhile in the mystical tradition? What should be left behind? How do you read it selectively? Because there are things that should be left behind. The mystical tradition is racist, misogynist, you may say. Certainly privileges men over women dramatically, and certainly privileges Jews over Gentiles dramatically. You can find passages in Jewish mystical literature that say only Jews have divine souls. Gentiles have mere animal souls. So there's stuff that belongs to the Middle Ages and should be left there. But that doesn't mean that the whole thing has to be set aside or has to be under the rug.
I want to ask you, I think two different questions, so I'm going to take it in turns. The first question is this. I'm wondering, as you reflect on the condition of Jews today, maybe American Jews, but maybe beyond that, and think about the past times when the mystical tradition became more prominent. I'm thinking of the founding of Hasidism and perhaps I know less about it, but those periods in the medieval times when the Zohar was put together, the Kabbalistic tradition. And we've been thinking a lot about, you know, particularly American Jews today, that they sort of are so much more well-educated than Jews have ever been throughout history in terms of general knowledge. But then with access to digital technology, that they have the opportunity to access knowledge very easily and very quickly, and that will only grow. And so in a sense, there's a greater capacity among the average Jews to sort of deal with much more complex, bigger issues, bigger ideas, perhaps, than your average Jew was able to before. And yet at the same time, there's also, of course, with all this general knowledge, there's this skepticism about a mystical tradition, you know, and so I'm thinking about at least the way that the story is often told about the Hasidic masters, and I'm sure that you have a different take on it, but that they were very appealing to the more simple Jews who perhaps didn't have as much knowledge, Jewish or otherwise, and were sort of following these spiritual masters. And I guess I'm sort of wondering how we transpose that into the modern times when the Jews are not simple and are really having all of these struggles and all of these thoughts in so many different careers and so many areas. And yet, as you say, the non-mystical conception of God is completely fallen down. So it seems that only a more mystical concept could work. And yet there's also this alternative reality of the Jews. So I'm wondering if you think that makes it more likely to become a sort of popular version of Judaism, or more likely to stay within a smaller group.
So let me ask a different question. Why has this quest for recovering the mystical tradition begun? What happened between 1980 and 1990 that suddenly people were interested in Kabbalah? I think we have to look at this in a broader context, and that will, in an indirect way, respond to your question. I think since about 1750, maybe earlier, the real religion of the West has been the religion of science, a kind of scientism. Truth is scientific truth. We know something if we know it scientifically. Progress is scientific progress. We may dress up that belief in science and lightly in a liberal Judaism or a liberal Christianity, but essentially what we really believe in is science. I think that religion of scientism suffered terrible blows in the middle of the 20th century. Two of them may be named as Auschwitz and Hiroshima. I'm not making a moral equivalency between them, but they were both great, great blows to faith in science as that which will solve our problems, or that which will make us better people, that which will help us survive. Suddenly, science becomes that which will destroy us, not that which will help us survive. That which will destroy us because of nuclear holocaust, or that which will destroy us because of environmental degradation, because we're going to destroy the world, because we're consuming so much thanks to our scientific revolutions. I think in response to that crisis, since the 1960s, many of the great minds of humanity have been asking the question, is there some ancient wisdom that was neglected or set aside in the course of this rush toward modernity that might save us from ourselves? When I was on campus as a college kid, it was Zen Buddhism just being discovered, Zen and the art of this and that. Then it became the turn of the various Indian gurus, the autobiography of a yogi, and then the Maharishi, of course. Then it was the Tibetan, maybe God, the truth, that which will save us is found in a Tibetan mountaintop, either metaphorical or literal. I think the quest for Kabbalah is part of that same search. Is there some wisdom humanity has? Are there some deeper resources toward which we might turn that might keep us from destroying ourselves, from consuming ourselves? And I think we have something to contribute to that conversation, along with the Tibetan master and the Zen master and the Christian mystic and the Sufi and so on. So I think that's part of what's going on. There is some human quest for an alternative way to live based on a deeper and ancient truth. And I want to help make the wisdom of Kabbalah and Hasidism accessible to participants in that quest.
I'd love to open up a concept that always looms, or at least often looms, in conversations about God, which is the related concept of commandedness, of obligation, of rule following. Because the second you start to expand or redefine God in the ways that you're talking about, where it's not this personality that verbs human beings, that says to do things, that relates, the second you do that, commandedness, the idea that there's a God commanding us to do things and that therefore we follow the rules, it gets complicated. Like it doesn't really make sense anymore. So I'm curious to hear, because you've written about this and it's really convincing to me, what your take is on obligation, on commandedness, and its role, or maybe its non-role, in contemporary Judaism.
I think a spiritual life needs discipline. We are pretty undisciplined creatures, we human beings. We are pretty torn from our deeper pursuits by efforts like child raising and making a living and surviving and political protest and all the kinds of things we feel an obligation to be involved in. So that to say I have a regular spiritual life, I am a serious seeker, requires the imposition of some discipline That's what organized religion is about at its best, providing disciplinary tools to help create regular patterns of spiritual awareness. The problem of spiritual quest is not how to gain great insights. Many of us have great insights. We've been to the top of the mountain, to use an overused metaphor. The question is what to do with that top of the mountain on a boring Tuesday afternoon when you're distracted and busy and just don't feel like it. And that's where the discipline of religion is valuable. Well, I have an obligation to notice the setting sun and to acknowledge it, in meditation or in prayer or in chant or whatever I do, because that's part of my daily discipline. So I'm going to pay attention to it, even though this is a busy Tuesday afternoon. And so I stop and I pay attention. And that commitment to discipline enables me, helps me to do that. I think that's how religious ritual should be used. It redeems us from the tyranny of ordinariness, of every day being the same. Shabbat, the Sabbath, is the center of Jewish ritual life, of course. And the idea that we weekly celebrate the creation of the world and that we participate somehow in the world's weekly recreation by stopping everything and getting off the treadmill for a day, that's to me a great gift of the tradition. I said a great gift of the tradition, not of God. I don't know that God commanded me to keep the Sabbath. I understand the tradition has said to me, the tradition has taught me, by placing the commandments of Shabbat, by placing not the commandment, but the fact of Shabbat, in the very story of the creation of the world, God creates the world in 6 days and rests on the seventh, right after creating human beings. I think the Torah is saying to me, human life is inconceivable without rest, without the ability to get off the treadmill. As soon as there are human beings on the sixth day, there has to be leisure on the seventh. There has to be rest on the seventh, because that's what makes for humanity. And so I choose to partake of that rest, not because God has commanded me and is watching and will reward me if I do it or punish me if I don't do it. That was a sort of childlike way of enforcement, which for me is a part of the past. I do not know a God who personally watches to see whether I am observing the commandments or not observing the commandments. No. The commandments to me are a gift that the tradition has given me for disciplining and regularizing my spiritual life. I choose to accept them insofar as they work to enhance that spiritual life. Because the tradition has lots of experience and lots of wisdom, I find myself open to hearing from it and to saying, this is how you do it. After a lot of years of ambivalence, I have become, in my old age, a pretty consistently observant traditional Jew. By no means would I call myself Orthodox, but I look like one and act like one, you might almost say. I don't think about obligation and law, but I do think about personal commitment and spiritual discipline. In some ways, you could say a good deal of religion is gone for me, of traditional Western religion. A good deal of it is gone. When the fellow in the sky was not permitted by my atheist grandmother, a big piece of what works as traditional religion no longer worked for me. And yet, since I was still a seeker and since I was still very Jewish, I picked up the broken pieces. You know, the Talmud says a beautiful phrase, both the whole and broken tablets were placed in the ark. After Moses smashed the tablets, you remember, and then the new set of tablets was given following the golden calf, Moses picked up the broken, somebody picked up the broken pieces along with the new tablets, and they were placed in the ark together. I like to say the broken pieces were put there for our generation, which can only learn from, at least for people like me in our generation, who can only learn from broken pieces. Give me shards, give me broken pieces, let me try to puzzle how to fit them together, and I'll become very engaged in the project. hand me the whole package and I'll say no thanks.
So this is a piece that I really struggle with in terms of the Jewish practice. You know, it may sound a little silly, but it's something that I've also really struggled with in watching the television show The Crown, because I was, you know, when you watch the show about the British monarchy and you sort of see who they really are, you know, human beings, the thing that I was really struggling with is, you know, I understand why it's still valuable for Great Britain to have a monarchy, but why do they bow to her? You know, meaning that they understand that she's just a person. Why are they bowing down to her? And in a sense, I think I really struggle with that in terms of Jewish practice, in the sense that if I accept the notion of God, or I really appreciate you're saying that the English word is very problematic, but the notion that you're talking about, which I can really get behind, it makes it really hard for me, though, to understand what am I accomplishing in 3 hours at services, sort of beseeching and praying to and requesting of, and even paying homage to an entity that I don't really believe is there, when the entity that I really do believe is there, that sort of indwelling oneness, we're not talking to that entity, you know, or we don't have language that's sort of talking about that. And what I think that that really does for us is that we have to step up and take responsibility in a way that we didn't really do and understand before. And so some of that language feels to me like it's actually getting in the way of our doing what we need to do if we truly understand that we are part of that oneness, which is to stop praying to it and start acting.
I am a borderline figure. I'm still attracted to the old language. I know it's not going to work anymore. I still grew up in my grandparents' shul, and they were on the other grandparents, the other side of the family, the traditional side. I still grew up in their shul and love the melodies and even love the words, even though I'm not any kind of literal believer in them. I've spent many years writing my own commentary to the Hebrew prayer book, trying to create a bridge between what I believe and those old words, which don't say what I believe at all. It's a big effort. Most people in your generation are not going to make that effort, especially when they don't have my emotional attachment to the old words. I fully recognize that. And I think it is time for us to create a Judaism that is more one of meditation and of wordless song, nigunim, melodies without words, but melodies that open the heart, and new kinds of liturgy, more that than I am capable of creating. I'm partly not capable of creating it because I'm not a musician or a poet. I'm also not very capable of creating it because I still have such deep roots in the old. But I know that it's not the language of the Jewish future. Yes, this is a different kind of religious conception. It needs a different kind of religious language. I would like to see women participating fully in creating that along with men, let me say. Of the rabbis I train, more than half are women. And the future leadership of Judaism has to shift in that way, fully including that half of Jewry that had been left behind. And women may have a particular role in helping to create that new religious language. But I think it will be a language that is more one of silence and melody than one of words. Maybe one of few words, maybe taking some chants from the old tradition. I would be happy if in a synagogue, any major synagogue or any major Jewish center, alongside the traditional liturgical service that goes on, there was a place for a half hour of Jewish meditation, maybe ending with just a calling out Shema Yisrael, Adonai Eloheinu, Adonai Echad. Maybe that's enough. But growing out of the depth of half an hour of silence, it might be more powerful than it is in the midst of a please turn to page 32 and rise prayer book. It's got to happen. It's got to come from people in your generation.
It's not often you hear people advocate for something that they themselves don't yet feel capable to do. And I just want to like pause and appreciate the magnitude of what that means. It's special. But I thought it'd be worthwhile at this point to shift gears a little bit. And I mean, you've given us some great anecdotes about your family, and how each side of your family has influenced you in different ways. I'd love to hear more just about your story, because you have played this pivotal role. I mean, you've been very humble and mentioned others in the 20th century who were a big part of bringing mysticism back into the Jewish equation, Gershom Scholem, etc. But you also have yourself played a huge role in that. And so I'd love to just hear some of your own journey. What caused you to go from a place of wherever you were as a child, coming from one side largely atheist, one side traditionalist, what caused you to go from that place to the place where you would write a book like Radical Judaism and have a philosophy and a theology like the one you are laying out today?
A lot of sweating. Yes, so I told you a little bit about the family. One side atheist, one side traditionalist. My dad, having been raised in an atheist home, was a militant, committed atheist. Thought religion was utter nonsense. Was shocked when I became involved with it. I remember being 7 or 8 years old and taking my mother to synagogue. Why she came with me, I'm not sure, but she did. My mother died when I was 11, and that was a traumatic, transformative event in my childhood. It pushed me further toward my mother's parents and their world and the world of religion and the need for religion. I discovered a little book called the Kitzur Shulchan Aruch, The Brief Guide to Jewish Law, and tried to observe as much as I could without calling down the fury of my father. And until I was 18, I was moving more and more toward a kind of orthodoxy, a kind of self-imposed religious orthodoxy. When I was 18 and a sophomore in college, I discovered it was all nonsense, that I had been kidding myself, that I had been hiding behind this facade of faith because I couldn't face the various issues in my life, including the mourning, which I'd never quite overcome and never quite dealt with properly. And so at age 18, I walked away from it completely. I tried on Jewish secularism, as I said. At that point, I had already met Zalman Schachter, who was important to me. And as I mentioned, Professor Altman, who was my teacher when I was a 20-year-old senior in college, teaching Kabbalah for the first time. One of the two of them, either Zalman or Professor Altman, I don't remember which, gave me an essay by a man in Hillel Zeitlin when I was 20 years old called The Fundaments of Hasidism. And I read it and said, this is the truth. This is what I'm going to believe. And someday I will translate this essay into English, and I'm going to be devoted to this language for the rest of my life. And I have been. There was something about this language of the oneness of being, of the mystery that underlay all things, that just spoke to my heart. It said to me that it was true. I had come to experience that or understand it, and I have been privileged now and then to discover it again, whether on mountaintops, real or metaphorical. Psychedelics were important to me for a while in the late 1960s. They fell out of my life as they'd come into it, but they were important to me at a certain point in my own spiritual journey. So was exposure to a lot of religious language from the East, although I never became an Eastern devotee, but I certainly read and studied Eastern religious language as well as Western. I couldn't be an Orthodox Jew anymore. I'd given up Orthodoxy. But I saw an intensity, a passion, a warmth in Orthodoxy that didn't exist in liberal Judaism as I'd encountered it. Why in a liberal synagogue do we have to have hundreds of people in a half-empty room, or maybe fewer than hundreds in a room that holds hundreds, with a sort of audience, theater seats, atmosphere where somebody says, now we all stand, now we all sit down, now we turn to page 23. As soon as somebody says, now we will please rise, I'm sort of checked out. Or we now turn to all the same page, I'm checked out. Because I need more spontaneity in my spiritual life than that. And so the idea of creating another kind of Judaism, which was small-scale, intimate, communal, for Jews who were not Orthodox. I used to say sometimes, the Chavura is a surrogate extended family for those of us who've left our extended families behind, who no longer have anything in common with our cousins or the world from which we came. So I have recreated small communities several times in my life. Now the rabbinical school where I teach is such a small community that I helped create. And I believe in intimate community. My wife used to say that some people, when they reach a certain age, get a new little red sports car every few years. Green gets a new little red rabbinical school. And in some ways, little red communities like that are places where I seem to thrive and where I seem to find people who want to hear what I have to say. So that's the story. I have left the secular academy behind three times for the sake of small religious communities. I was a doctoral student and I created the Chavura. I was a tenured professor at the University of Pennsylvania and I left it to go to the Reconstructionist Rabbinical College. I then had what had been my own teacher's chair at Brandeis, and I left that to go found a rabbinical school at Hebrew College in Boston. So I seem to like these little intense Jewish hothouse communities, and they seem to be as good to me as I am to them.
I was just wondering if, you know, as we sort of look ahead to the high holidays coming up, if you could just go back a little bit into our talking about God and divinity, and also that you've talked a lot about the way to sort of integrate our thinking about science, in particular evolution, into sort of an understanding of what we're seeking when we're seeking God. Could you give us a little bit more, you know, for those of us who struggle with this, could you give us a little bit more of a sense of what does divinity mean if it's not God, you know, if it's not the personal God that we often think of? You know, what is the difference between understanding this oneness and calling it divinity and understanding that there is no God? You know, what is the difference when the sort of facts are the same?
It's not about the facts. It's about the ability, the longing, and maybe the sense of imperative to open your heart. Before the oneness of the world, I open my heart. I recognize its majesty. I recognize the magnificence of this world. Whether it is because I'm standing on the top of Cadillac Mountain in Maine looking into the ocean, or because I am contemplating the patterns in the spider web in front of me, or because I'm watching the change of the seasons, or just because I'm thinking about a human being I love, or I'm watching my kid's mind develop, I am overwhelmed by the magnificence of it. And that magnificence calls upon me to open my heart to it, to open my heart and respond to it. Respond to it, of course, by actions, by preserving the world, by doing things to make it work. Also by actions to ask myself, okay, here you are, living for this split second in this ongoing planetary journey called evolution. What are you doing in that split second of yours? In the flick of an eye, you'll be gone. What are you doing in that split second of yours? What are you doing to push that evolutionary journey forward, to add something to it, to make it richer because you have lived here? And let's learn to be grateful. Gratitude, I want to say, maybe for a cap. Gratitude is what it's all about. Psalm 100 is Mizmor L'Todah in Hebrew. I translated a hymn to gratitude. I'm grateful for gratitude, because a sense of gratitude is often the first awakening of spiritual consciousness in our lives. I am grateful for the magnificence of this world and all its terror. And I'm grateful to be alive, and I'm grateful to have my eyes open the way I can appreciate it. To whom do I express that gratitude? Well, maybe I have to create a him or a whom or a her in order to express that gratitude, because my heart is full. And so that's what religion is about. So the facts are the same. The facts are the same. What they call upon you to do, both emotionally and as an activist, is what's different.
So we're arcing towards the close of this episode, and we often like to sort of come full circle and revisit something towards the beginning. And I want to circle back to what you identified as one of the great positive trends of the last few decades, which is that we've sort of found, and many American Jews are dedicating or rededicating or looking into mysticism through a Jewish lens. And you talked about how that's compared to the last couple hundred years where such sentiments were really pushed aside. That's a positive development. What I'd love to hear as we close is, what's one or two big positive changes that need to happen that haven't yet? Like, what do you look out and say, you know, this would be the analog to rediscovering mysticism between, you know, 1990 and now? Ironically, I was born in 1990. But what's the version of that that we need starting in 2018 through, you know, 2048?
We, the Jewish people? We who?
I'll let you define the we the Jewish people, or we the world.
Well, you immediately toss me into politics. You immediately toss me into saying we need to toss the bums out and reestablish the political order. I have never been as close to being a revolutionary as I am now since 1968. When I look and see what the level of threat is to the survival of the planet and the species, I say, I don't know how we're going to tolerate it, but I am devastated by what's going on in our society, in our world, especially the pullback from any commitment to planetary survival, and on issues of climate change, etc. So that for me has to come first, and finding a spiritual language that will convince people to do it, will convince people, will move people. And that spiritual language has got to be post-denominational, which is to say it's got to draw from Judaism and Buddhism and Christianity and all kinds of places. So that, I think, is the very first thing I want to say. If I'm stepping into the real world of political and social action, I have to say, we're going to have to deal with the Israel-Palestine problem in a very different way than we have as well, and understand that our commitment to every human being as the image of God applies to all human beings, and our denigration of the Palestinian neighbor has been a betrayal of Judaism at its best. How we make those changes, I'm not the guy to draw where the borders are and exactly what should be done about this issue and that issue. But I feel that we, the Jewish people, were given a great moral test. Just in the age when colonialism was breaking up over the world in 1948, we rediscover our ancient homeland and have to recreate it in a way that we cannot allow to be colonialist. Have we failed? Are we failing? How are we doing? Not very well, I'm afraid. That too will have to be dealt with in a way that makes us all more human, not less human. Let me say that.
Thank you so much for joining us. It's interesting. We just wrapped up a unit about Israel and Palestine, and we've been referencing back to it in certain senses, I think a little more than we expected to in this unit on God. So thank you for sharing that specific answer, but also all of your reflections today. It's been a great conversation.
Thanks for having me, and it's been a delight.
We hope you enjoyed this episode of Judaism Unbound. We certainly did, and we'll be reflecting a great deal on this conversation in the future. Thanks again to Art Green for joining us, and thanks to all of you out there for tuning in. We want to close out this episode in the same way that we always do, by encouraging you to be in touch with us, and there are a wide variety of ways for you to do that. First, you can head to our Facebook page, Judaism Unbound. Second, you can head to Twitter at Judaism Unbound. Third, you can go to our website, judaismunbound.com. And last but not least, you can hit us up via email at dan@judaismunbound.com or lex@judaismunbound.com. The last plug we'd like to make is that you can always support us with a financial donation, either on a monthly recurring basis or a one-time basis at judaismunbound.com/donate. We also want to remind you that we are in the midst of Elul Unbound, our month-long on-ramp month initiative to the High Holidays. The month that precedes the High Holidays is Elul, and we've got all sorts of digital stuff together that we're encouraging folks to explore this month. Definitely check it out on our website and sign up for our daily email list. There's still a little while left in this month of Elul before we hit the Jewish New Year. So thanks so much for listening. And with that, this has been Judaism Unbound.